Hello and welcome to Opus. I'm Gretchen Gondek for Siouxland Public Media. And back in studio after a couple of months is music director and conductor Ryan Haskins with our wonderful Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. Maestro.
Hi, Gretchen. Good to be back.
What's the good word?
All is well. Looking forward to a fresh 2018. I've been looking forward to this concert for a long time, so I'm happy to be back and share this wonderful music.
Well, really looking forward to this. I love Hovhannes, Debussy, Respighi. I'm curious as to what the thread is. I see a spiritual thread. Do you want to talk about how you put this program together?
Yeah. There are many threads, which I think sometimes is maybe we should talk about more threads. Because there are not only just threads through a program, but often through a season, and I try to lay that out. Sometimes it's more obvious than not, but other times they sort of go without speaking. But yeah, you've hit one of them certainly on the spiritual level. You know, when we're talking about Church Windows, obviously has an immediate religious sort of association. But the great thing about this is, two of these works on this program, actually, the music was written even before the concept was designed, or even the marketing, as I sometimes refer to it, as the title of the work was associated with the music. So both the Hovhannes and the Church Windows, the Respighi, were written before associated with anything. So we think about the Mysterious Mountain as this really amazing sonic painting of, you know, a description of whatever mountain or whatever mountain range it is. But actually, Hovhannes didn't write it to relate to mountains at all. After he wrote the music, it's hard not to continue to think about, well, come on, there's got to be some sort of comparison, because everything about that work, this three-movement, really prolific work, by the great American Hovhannes, has everything to sort of relate to mountains. I mean, down to phrasing, to dynamics, you know, hairpins where you have a crescendo and a diminuendo. So you've just, it's up the mountain, down the mountain, or you have these large arcing, beautiful phrases. I mean, you can't help but say, oh, yes, this is obviously being written specifically about mountains. But that's the great thing. It doesn't have that. But Hovhannes, an amazing composer, certainly one of the greatest American composers of the 20th century, had this sort of spiritual relationship with earth and with nature and with all things that are organic, and not just physically, but also, spiritually and in concept. You know, there's this sort of mystical, reverent, nostalgic concept that floats throughout all of his music, whether it's the Second Symphony or the First Symphony or anything else. So that's the great thing about this. There's this, for me, natural sort of spirituality for Hovhannes' music. And that, I think there's a huge difference between the religiosity of something and the spirituality of something. Because religion is something that's created by man, right? It's something that we've created for ourselves, where spirituality is something that exists, that's there, and that's felt. And this program expresses that at every corner, at every note. Same thing with the Respighi. The Respighi started off as a piano work. And it was because of his lovely wife, who they were only married for a couple of weeks, who she actually studied composition with him. She was a free thinker and voiced her opinion all the time, which I think is part of the reason why he married her. But 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the marriage, around 1918, 1919, she said, "You know, I've been fascinated by this Gregorian chant concept. Have you ever thought about it?" And he, you know, went away and considered it, and a day or two later came back and said, "Show me what this is," and immediately became obsessed. So all of the works from 1919, 1920 forward have this significant amount of Gregorian sort of chant and song associated with his music. We think of Pines of Rome and all of that sort of huge choral, almost like a orchestral organ concept. You know, you hear the organ, but it's not there. This sort of chordal approach to composition is a defining aspect of Respighi's music, and it was because of the simple conversation. And so he immediately wrote these three pieces about Gregorian chant for piano. And after he finished them, he thought, well, why don't we take this to a whole new level and turn them into some new experience? And so he orchestrated them. And so he orchestrated three and said, I want a fourth. So he added a fourth. And then a good friend of his, an editor, a professor of literature, sat down and said, okay, this is an amazing four-movement collection of color and emotion, but there's no title. There's no marketability about this, these pieces. So let's find something. And she suggested this concept about church windows. And from there, then they went even further and associated these sort of scenes, these biblical scenes, with each movement. And again, when you hear them, you can't help but associate these individual movements with those biblical scenes. You know, the four scenes are, the first is the flight into Egypt, and the description, which is printed in the score, of course, came after the music again, but it's printed in the score. The little caravan proceeds through the desert in a starry night, carrying the treasure of the world. And you hear this sort of Eastern sort of feel, this beautiful clarinet solo that starts in this unusual rhythm pattern that is not, you know, European. There's something different about it. And it makes you think of this nod to another world, such as Egypt. And it's perfect, and it fits exactly into the description. The second movement is this fireball of music. It's the Saint Michael, the archangel, and the description is: and a great battle was made in the heavens. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and fought the dragon with his and his angels, but these did not prevail, and there was no more place for them in heaven. And so it's this huge, massive sort of battle within the orchestra, strings going crazy and brass blowing the heck out of the instruments, very percussive movement. So it's again, fits perfectly into the description. The third movement, the Matins of St. Clair, but Jesus Christ, her bridegroom, was wishing to leave her thus discontent, and her miraculously and had her miraculously carried by the angels to the church of, and it goes on and on to describe all of these beautiful, delicate moments in the third movement. It's probably the most intimate, I would say, within a 10-year period of that, of composition, is this third inner movement of the work. That's just so touching and such beautiful writing. And the last is St. Gregory. We have this quote that all of a sudden, in the middle of this beautiful chorale-like writing, the organ itself, which is part of the score, has this solo of the chorale of St. Gregory. I mean, it's just a remarkable combination of all of these instruments, massive orchestra, and just some powerful, powerful music. It's going to be pretty incredible.
Is it going to be any kind of visual elements to accompany the music?
Yeah, so we're, this is always a delicate area. You know, I never want to detract from the music itself, because I think the music itself serves what the composer wanted. But the Orpheum will be transported into some sort of visual place during this concert. And it will definitely, my hope is that within this specific work, that the audience actually feels like they're in the middle of some of this stained glass of these church windows, that you're actually physically incorporated, not just sonically, but just physically, that you're sort of transported, which, as you know, and as many of the listeners know, that that's the great thing about some of these amazing masterpieces of music, that all you have to do is close your eyes for 5 seconds and immediately you're transported into this foreign land or, moment in time. That's the amazing thing about what we do. But again, this music lived and breathed before any association with any of these titles or any sort of concept, which to me, some people may then minimize the concept of how this relates to the actual words and descriptions and comparisons to color and all this. But actually, for me, it does just the opposite and makes it even more strong. Again, that's the magic of live performance, and especially in a concert hall or a venue, that you can be having one experience and your neighbor sat next to you, or your partner who you've known for your life, who you know every thought and can finish a sentence, can have a completely different experience and walk out and say, "Wow, did you feel that?" And the other person, "No, I felt this." That's the greatest thing, because those moments don't exist too often anymore in our lives, I don't think. That sort of spontaneity, that creative injection of these moments where they keep us alive and remind us of what it's all about, I think.
We also want to talk about another work, a shorter work, and I love this in the French. I hope I say it right. La Quatre Dalles Agglouties.
Agglouties, yeah.
The Sunken Cathedral.
Yeah, this is this legend, this Breton legend is something very special. So it's not a... When Debussy, of course, he wrote this originally for piano, and there are, of course, 24 preludes. Colin Matthews, who's the orchestrator, the arranger, and a very, very wonderful composer, worked with Mark Elder, a great British conductor, and sort of started this adventure with preludes of Debussy. And I would say that not all preludes that start at the piano can always be turned into orchestral works, but certainly the music of Debussy, I think, can. It has this, of course, this impressionistic quality throughout all of his music, but it works so well with the colors and dynamic variants within the orchestral world. And the legend in this story essentially is, you know, the clearest mornings, when the sea is transparent, this legend of this sunken cathedral starts to have life. And so from underneath the sea, you start to hear chanting priests and tolling bells and gongs and an organ and all of these sort of mystical sounds from underneath the water. So this prelude starts with that concept in mind. And slowly as it evolves, the cathedral emerges inch by inch until the entire cathedral is revealed, still dripping with water, and you still hear that in the music. So you hear this evolving of the orchestration and the color and the warmth, and suddenly the cathedral is in front of you alive. And you hear these huge, full brass chorales and these magnificent bell tolls, not just in the percussion section, but throughout the orchestra. And it has this, again, spiritual presence. And then suddenly, as it sat there, it starts to sink again. So the music starts to close up. And there's a beautiful moment when the cathedral, the last tip of the peak, finally sinks below the water. And you hear in the strings this sort of bubbling moment of that, you know, when you drop something into water and you have these leftover bubbles that sort of come to the surface. It's sort of that feeling that you actually can hear, this sort of effervescent kind of quality to the water after something has just been put in. And you hear that start in the strings, and then you hear those chants again from underwater. So it's this muted sort of covered sound in the brass. It's 5 minutes of music, but it can really change your life with just the exploration of Debussy's music, but also reimagined into the orchestra. It's really something spectacular. I've been wanting to bring it here for a while, and finally, I think this is the perfect program for it.
What would seem to me, all three of these composers on the program are drawing from well, the spiritual realm, mm. which we've discussed, but also the Armenian roots of Hovhannes, which yeah. I think is really interesting mm-hmm. because wasn't Armenia the one country that chose to remain under communism?
Yeah, it's a very, this, so Hovhannes is an American composer, of course, but his family and everything about his upbringing was started in the Armenian tradition. But there was a point in his life when he composed within this sort of style, in this sort of recognition of his roots. And then at a certain point, he established it's time to change. And so when that world changes, it doesn't necessarily close him down, but actually opened him up even more so. So we start to see, and this, the Second Symphony of Hovhannes, The Mysterious Mountain, it's there are, between the First Symphony and the Second Symphony, there are about 19 works that he wrote. So the numbers are all over the place. In fact, there's even controversy of the opus number of the symphony, that when Stokowski said, I want something for the Houston Symphony opening night, Hovhannes wrote this little fanfare, that's this little, you know, couple-minute fanfare. And Stokowski said, well, I want it to be more significant, because he had worked with him on the First Symphony. And Hovhannes went away and produced this magnificent three-movement symphony. But the it didn't have a title. Again, it didn't have opus numbers, so the legend is that they just threw numbers in. So those numbers don't even relate to the order of where it was written. Again, it doesn't matter. What matters is the music. The rest is just, you know, frill and froth, I guess, which is really refreshing, actually. But yeah, this work was composed into that transitional period when he was coming out, into when he moved to New York, when things were changing for him. And he also had this very worldly appreciation for cultures then outside of his own roots. So huge fascination with India. And we actually hear that in the last movement of this symphony, where he associates with this the Indian raga, a formation of essentially how you mark bars, measures. Raga is a pattern of rhythms, and so this 13 note sort of raga that comes through into the third movement. It's just amazing, and sort of this we live in this Phrygian world of mode, and so it has this nod to sort of Eastern, unusual Eastern colors with you hear gongs, you hear non-traditional effects, but there are no gongs. It's all in the strings. It's just this whole concert is all about what you can imagine and what is brought to life through effects and color and range within the entire symphonic experience. And I think it's a really powerful night. And we haven't even mentioned the composer of the year, which actually falls into it just as well. Patrick O'Malley, who's our 2018 composer of the year, will be joining us from LA. He's in the middle of his doctorate there. Patrick has a very interesting life. He definitely has a color, a sound to his compositions, but he also is mixed into many different worlds, including film and conducting, and even video game music, which is unusual. But his music, I think, is really something special. And this work that's written for string orchestra only explores color and non-specific moments of, you know, if we had the score to look at, you'd see that he gives you 10 bars of music, 10 measures of music. And there are all of these notes that are specifically written, but the note from the composer is, play these as you feel they should be played, which, giving that instruction to 40, 45 members of a string section, you're not going to get the same interpretation. But that's what he wants. So you have these moments of music where it's sort of this free-for-all. But it, as everyone's part of that free-for-all, it presents one moment. It's very, I don't know, cerebral. I think it's very cool and very exploratory and unique. And what you experience in this piece is really something special, and I think it has a voice, and so we're so happy to bring him here to town to hang out and do some outreach, and then of course be there for the program.
And in fact, later on in our opus today, we'll be hearing from him, so I'm looking forward to that a little bit later.
Absolutely.
In the program. Also, Siouxland Youth Symphony.
Yes, and I failed to mention that they're part of the Second Symphony, the Hovannis. They'll be joining us for that work. And I've had the chance to work with them this week, and they're sounding great. And I always, whenever I go to a youth orchestra, wherever, for preparing for a side-by-side with the main orchestra, I always like to know how many people have done the side-by-side, how many have not. And this group is probably about half and half, which is really exciting because as musicians, we all remember our first time when we had the side-by-side experience. I can still remember what piece it was. I remember how quickly the hairs on the back of my neck popped up because that, again, sitting in the middle of orchestra, it might be one thing for an audience member to hear an orchestra live seated in front, but when you're dropped into the middle of it, and feel that sound and the vibrations and the dynamics and the coloring and everyone focusing on one performance or one rehearsal together, it's an indescribable feeling. And those are the really great things about side-by-sides, is to give these young people that opportunity to experience that.
Well, Ryan, kudos to you. I know one of your focus of your mission is to educate, mm-hmm. And cultivate younger musicians. So this is a very important experience for them.
It sure is. And, you know, it's you know, people say, well, why do you spend time to do this? You know, if it's, you know, it's sort of a hobby, you know, they're in soccer and basketball and football and art class and music lessons and all this and, you know, give a child like that an opportunity, and then, you know, they never think about it again. But that's not what this is about at all. You know, we may have four, you know, grand violin soloists, or we may have one, or we may have none. But it's about the appreciation, and it's about experience. And I think when we think about when young people are growing up, we think about every opportunity that they can have as far as an experience, right? We think about that as in our own lives. We retrace our steps and think about this moment when we, you know, you smell something and you automatically think back to that moment when you were 7 years old. I mean, how special is that? It's all sort of along the same lines of that just basic appreciation and the exposure to culture and arts and expression, and in the end, I think it adds weight to figuring out how each of us plays a role into society and what we bring to a community and to a culture, and it helps us figure out our purpose. You know, we're not just a doctor, we're just not a teacher, we're not just a garbage collector or a, I don't know, steel worker, but we play a role, where we play a purpose, and with that comes the remembrances of our experiences, and we become who we are because of those amazing opportunities. And that's what we're providing for these young special people. So,
oh, the word visceral comes to mind for Saturday night, and
oh, yeah.
I always feel so much more alive when I leave the symphony concert, and it's just something, if you've never experienced it, this would be a great program to experience the wonder of classical music and all of those spiritual elements that we've talked about today on Opus.
Absolutely. Yeah, I always think whenever talking about spirituality and religious, you know, anything religious in classical music, obviously you work as a musician with many different people from many different backgrounds and maybe not the same beliefs. But I remember a very important lesson when I was young, early studying conducting. And one of my mentors at that time, we were conducting the B minor mass of Bach. And we had a choir full of people from all over the world, but the majority of them were all Jewish, singing the B minor mass. And a reporter was interviewing him and brought to the question, this is a little unusual, isn't it? How, you know, they're singing about something that's not part of their faith, that, you know. And my mentor simply said, it's not about the actual words, it's about the spirituality, and it's about performing and presenting this art. And true artistry is an expression of all of those things combined. And so, you know, whether it's a work for ceremonial gamelan work, you know, or a piece for a gamelan, or some sort of ceremonial work, or whether it's a work by many of the great composers who lived through and survived, and some didn't, through Holocaust, whether it's revisiting that music and understanding that culture and bringing that to life, you know, having the background or not, or it's the B minor mass or whatever, or if it's Church Windows, it doesn't really matter. It's that thread and that powerful moment of spirituality and what it plays in our lives, which is really at the heart of all of this.
That is the extraordinary thing about music. And we hope people will come and experience that Saturday evening, 7:30. Is there a pre-concert conversation?
There is, yeah. Patrick O'Malley and I will be talking at 6:45 about even more details on the concert. So if that is your first time coming to the concert, that's always a wonderful way to get behind the scenes and look at the music that you're about to experience. It's a great opportunity for that.
Well, it's been a phenomenal season, but it's far from over. Do you want to talk about March 10th and then what's coming up in April?
Yeah, we have a great performance coming up in March with Cherish the Ladies. Just one of the most entertaining group of gals that I know. Just every concert they've ever done that I've seen and heard about, it's just a night full of entertainment. And they're bringing dancers. So it's the full symphony orchestra with their band, some with traditional Celtic music. It's one of the most authentic Celtic performances around. There are a lot of them. There are a lot of things that that market themselves that way. But this really is the authentic. I mean, you have the leader. The leader is the world champion of the tin flute. You can't get more authentic than that. and have won accolades, you know, on behalf of Ireland to, you know, recognize their sort of prolific journey as women in a male-dominated world of Irish music, Celtic music. These are the leaders, and they're doing it so, so well. So it's going to be great to host them. Lots of opportunities to not only enjoy that evening, but also to hang out with them after, too. So check that out.
And then we are really looking forward to the April concert.
Yeah, April has been, West Side Story has been a journey, and I'm still in awe about how it's all coming together. You know, since I've seen you last, I've heard, I think it's about 1,000 auditions for this cast in New York City. And we have some special cameos featuring some local people that the community will be familiar with. But cast of 32 people now, a production team that represents pretty much every corner of the world. From director to choreographer to stage designer to production manager to costume designer to lighting designer. The entire production will live and breathe here in Sioux City starting on April 2nd. So that's, they're in town for 21 days for this production to make it all come together. All supported and played in amazing fashion by the Sioux City Symphony. And the unique part of this production is that you actually see the orchestra on stage with the entire production, which is historic. You won't have the opportunity, and you've never, I know for a fact, you've never seen it like that before, and you probably won't for a very long time into the future. So this is unique on many different levels. We're breaking history as we do here.
Well, that's what you do, Ryan. And you do it so beautifully. Well, again, we want to encourage people to attend the concert this Saturday night, 7:30 at the Orpheum Theater, preceded by a talk with Composer of the Year and Ryan Haskins at 6:45. Mm-hmm. And you can contact Trinette. She can get you a ticket at 277-2111. You can get your tickets online. You can show up at the door. But this is a concert not to miss.
Yep. Please, please come and experience this really magical evening.
And we're continuing our conversation on Opus today with Patrick O'Malley, who has just participated in Western Iowa Tech's Lifelong Learning Program. He's had a full schedule today. First of all, Patrick, welcome to Siouxland Public Media. It's a great privilege to meet you.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here. I'm so thankful to be working with the symphony.
Well, we're very delighted about the program tomorrow night, but reading your vitae, I was interested in the fact that mathematics led to piano lessons and film music and video game design.
Yeah.
You want to connect the dots for
sure.
us on that?
I'll do it very quickly. So I started out on piano lessons when I was about in kindergarten or first grade. And the reason I started was because my mother saw me doing math problems and doing well at them. And she was like, well, if she's good at math, he'll be good at music, I think. So I did piano lessons and that, you know, for several years, and that led to me becoming proficient enough at the keyboard to start making my own things up. And then at some point in middle school, I realized I enjoyed making up music more than practicing it. And that kind of led me to start writing things down. And at about the same time, this was about 2000, 2001, movies like Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings were coming out. And my family didn't really go to the orchestra that often. They do now because they know I'm, you know, doing orchestra stuff. But my introduction to the orchestra really happened more at the movie theater than at the symphony hall. And at home on VHS and DVD, you know, watching Star Wars and you know, Kenneth Branagh films and all that. And so that led me to really discover the orchestra as this wonderfully expressive, colorful thing that you can write for. And it's just like writing for the piano, except there's a lot of staves instead of just two. So that's how I kind of got started writing music. I didn't really know what I was doing for a long time. And ever since then, I've been working mostly in classical music, writing for, you know, concerts like the one that's happening this Saturday. But I've also been doing some stuff in film and video games on the side because those two genres, they need orchestral music just like the symphony hall needs orchestral music. And I've found that my classical training, I've, you know, did an undergrad, master's, and currently doing a doctorate in composition, have really helped prepare me to bring a lot to the table in those other scoring genres. And I do, I've not just done a bunch of short films, but I also am an arranger and a conductor for a live concert tour called Journey Live, which is the music of Austin Wintry, which is where I'm serving as, you know, the chamber music liaison to Austin's big symphonic score and condensing it down into a chamber group and doing the music that way. So that's kind of where what I'm working on. Mostly classical, but here and there, little film and game stuff on the side.
Well, I could talk to you for hours about film scores because I love film. And you referenced Lord of the Rings, the trilogy. Is it possible for you to talk about a favorite film score? Is that too broad of or too narrow of a question?
I can talk about one. Yeah, Lord of the Rings was definitely the one that made me like super notice film music, just because it was such a big movie, and at that age, you know, this was, you know, the epic of for any, you know, middle school boy was, you know, this was the big, you got to go see this movie type of thing. But Since then, I've kind of gravitated toward film scores that seek a balance between the traditional romantic, big, emotional, uplifting sounds and also the challenging, the otherworldly, the dissonant and the dark. And in that journey, my favorite composer who writes for films is Elliot Goldenthal, who won an Oscar in 2002 for Frida. And he works with his partner, Julie Taymor, who people might know as the director of the Lion King Broadway show. And I think in 2000 or 2001, they made a film called Titus, which is an adaptation of Titus Andronicus with Anthony Hopkins. And that score has so many different ideas in it. They're all woven together with a single theme, but the music in that film is so unexpected and emotional that I think it's just something, I think it's fabulous. And, I bring my composer friends over to my house to watch the movie because they don't know what it is, because it's, it's kind of an obscure film at this point. But I'd say that's probably one of the films that gets me every time I watch it is that score, because it has everything from the big, huge choir and orchestra down to a jazz band, to a circus march, to electronics, to all this heart-wrenchingly, heavy music and violent music, and then redemptive music all at the end in that final scene. That would be a one that sticks in my mind. There are others, of course, but that's the big one.
That's interesting. I remember that film and mm-hmm. remember it was quite bold. Jessica Lange. But I'm not really remembering the music, but I know that we have the film score here. So I'm going to look into that.
I think it's not a film that you're going to be humming on the way out of the movie theater into your car, but it's it deals with subtleties that I think in a way that really heightened the drama. I mean, the first time I saw the movie too, it was hard enough to kind of get the story with the Shakespearean language. So much as just take it all in, but I knew that I felt that there was something really special happening there. And I of course love the big names like John Williams and James Horner and Jerry Goldsmith, and even going back further to Herman and Korngold. I don't think any film composers really captured human suffering like Elliot has. but maybe, I don't know if that says something weird about me, but I enjoy it, yeah. And I have a very, I've listened to a lot of film scores myself, so. A big breadth of tastes is what I try and, keep as my listening regiment.
Your composition, Loneliness in a Beautiful Place, is going to be presented tomorrow night at the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. What a lyrical name. I love this. Mm-hmm. Talk about the piece. I know it's scored for strings only. Right. The inspiration and kind of what we're going to expect to hear.
So the genesis of the piece was I was awarded a fellowship to go to Wyoming, to Grand Teton National Park, which is just south of, I think south of Yellowstone. And they commissioned me to write a string quartet. And they suggested that the quartet be some sort of nature-related piece. You could do anything from something based on the park to, you could write a piece about the buffalo or the ecology. And I kind of thought, well, that sounds a little specific for me. I'd like something a little bit more transcendent. So I wrote this piece, which is all about the experience of going to someplace beautiful that you've never been to before. So the piece starts in this very kind of uncertain way where at first there isn't any sound at all. And then the players start to make a tiny sound with their instruments. And then a sound builds from that, this kind of trill sound. And this is over like 10 or 15 seconds only, but it's about creating this uncertainty. And then finally, the basses and cellos enter the slow C, and a viola solo happens, and you realize, okay, this is going to be a lyrical, beautiful piece now that we've entered whatever realm we're in. And the audience is, I hope, going to have their own experience individually on how they imagine what their imagination does when they hear that. The title, Loneliness in a Beautiful Place, is ironically inspired by an offhand comment a game developer made when discussing one of his games. I believe his name is Jonathan Blow, and he was talking about a game called The Witness, which is a puzzle game set on a deserted island. And he was talking about the feeling he wanted to capture being loneliness in a beautiful space. And I was like, oh, that's a wonderful little phrase. I'll just use that and change it a little bit. And so that's where I got the title from. It fit what I was trying to do. I wrote the piece at my family's house over the summer, two summers ago, in Charlevoix, Michigan, which is on a lake and not really in a town. It's kind of by itself. So I was in that sort of big spatial environment to write a piece that was about that. And yeah, so the audience, I hope, will have a very individual experience with this piece and how they think about their own relationship to nature, not in any sort of, you know, social political way, but just in a way based on memory, in a way based on what is it about being in large spaces that is important to them or that has been meaningful to them.
Well, I think this fits beautifully within the scope of the program. I think it's going to be a very boundary-breaking evening, but I'm so looking forward to hearing your composition. Mm-hmm. And if people would like to listen to you explain in detail, they can attend the 6:45 pre-concert talk with you and our conductor, Ryan Haskins.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a place where people can ask questions as well?
I hope so, yes. Oh, okay. I welcome questions, very much so. I think I really enjoy connecting with audiences. I think new music should make an endeavor to connect with, you know, audiences while still being satisfying for the composer to write. And I encourage any sort of dialogue. You know, you mentioned we just did this adult learning class, and you know, that's a group of people that don't know a lot about music. We had a few trained musicians who could follow the music, but some were completely not music people. They were just there to learn. And if I can write a piece that speaks to both the people who know something about music and the ones who don't know anything about music, then I think that, you know, I've done a successful job to some extent.
Tell us about your day in Sioux City. I know you've been doing some outreach, and is it East High? Did you go, or West High?
Yeah, we went to the East High in high school, and we went to a audio tech class, which is, if I remember my own high school days, a class that probably includes learning about basic sequencing software. They were using learning how to use Audacity, and probably learning how to work with loops and just do basic production things. And for that, I talked mostly about my work with Journey and with Austin Wintry, where, you know, breaking down a scene in the video game Journey and showing how the composer put the score together, how the way the game works, the composer chose to write little chunks of music that, when implemented into the game, form one seamless body of music. But the reason why it's written in chunks is because the player can make all these sorts of different choices depending on who's playing the game and how fast they go through the game or where they go in the game. So the music has to be manipulated, has to be flexible in terms of when things happen. So that was something we discussed, and hopefully they got something out of it. It was fun to demonstrate.
I'm intrigued by something I saw in an interview that you did previously. Could you talk about Kaleidoscope?
Sure. Kaleidoscope Chamber Orchestra is a Los Angeles-based orchestra. Their main feature, I guess, is that they are a conductorless orchestra, which means that they do orchestral pieces, symphonies, tone poems, etc., but without using a conductor. And the reason they do that is it requires the musicians to really know the music. I don't want to say take responsibility for it, but bring a sense of interpretation to the table that normally a conductor would be responsible for or be in charge of, and do the rehearsal that way. They spend more time rehearsing than a normal orchestra would because they have all these voices as part of the ensemble. Anybody can say anything about the piece they're rehearsing. But when it comes together, it's quite impressive when you have a full orchestra playing a Mahler symphony with no conductor and see how the musicians look at each other, how they cue each other, how they lock into each other when things change. And it's really impressive that they're able to do that. And they've made it sort of one of their goals to champion new music. And I had the pleasure of working with them last year on a piece it was a duo piece for clarinet and viola called Paths Penumbra. They do a chamber music series in addition to the orchestra stuff. And it's currently the recording I have on my website because they played it very well, and it was a joy to work with them.
You seem to be in a very good place career-wise. I mean, you're finishing your doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
What is ahead for you? And you're so young, and you have already accomplished so much. And I just wonder, what is there left for you to do?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure if I even know the answer to that. Well, I do know the answer to that. I guess what the question is how do I get there? When I finish my doctorate, I intend to stay in Los Angeles unless something huge changes. And now I've invested basically all of my time in graduate school to writing for classical music, for orchestras and chamber music. I fit in film and game stuff on the side when I can. I just did a session at Warner Brothers, actually, at a conducting workshop being held in Burbank at the studio, and I had a very short orchestral piece read there. So I'm fitting in these little scoring gigs or whatever in the spare time between going to school and finishing school and writing classical music. Once I finish the doctorate, I'm hoping that I will be able to find some work in Los Angeles as some sort of scoring musician, whether that be the big name composer or the orchestrator who, takes the composer's music and prepares it for the orchestra. I'm not sure. We'll just see where things take me, and I'm trying to meet as many people as I can in town. I've met many wonderful session musicians who are also very talented chamber music players and orchestra players in the contemporary music scene as well. And whatever collaborations come out of that and whatever work opportunities come out of that, I look forward to. So I guess I don't know exactly the answer about that. Other than right now, I'm just solely focused on, one, finishing school, two, doing opportunities like this, like the Sioux City, a competition, which I think every young composer should apply, who has an orchestra piece, should apply to. And, one step at a time is basically what I've been doing. I've been doing that since I moved out to California. Moving out to California and being at a school like USC, where you're immediately surrounded by so many talented people who are interested in doing exactly what you're interested in doing, really does help step your game up and try and do the best you can. And I'm hoping just to keep that work continuing. And yeah.
Well, it's going to be fun to follow your career. Mm-hmm. And this has been just wonderful for me to have an opportunity to visit with you, Patrick. One last question. Have you been in the hall yet?
No, I have not. I will be attending tonight's rehearsal. The orchestra has read through the piece apparently once already, so I know the parts are correct, thankfully. But I have not been in the hall, and I look forward to listening not just to my piece, but to all the pieces be rehearsed, and so I can hear the orchestra and how Ryan works and what the musicians are like, not just with the piece that they don't know like mine, but with music that's perhaps a bit more familiar. Every piece on the concert is kind of, none of them are big hits, really, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. It really helps instill this idea that the concert hall isn't just a museum where you go to listen to pieces you already know. It can also be a place where you experience new pieces, not just premieres like mine, but also pieces that have been underplayed, such as Respighi's Church Windows. I don't know any other orchestra that's done that. I mean, I'm sure there are many, but not ones that I've been to. Hovhannes is certainly an established name, but not a big name. And then you have the Debussy, which is a famous piece, but it's an orchestration of a piano piece, which is slightly unusual. Not unheard of, but, it's no Beethoven 5, so the audience is in for an experience that's going, where everything is probably, there's going to be something new for everybody with all the pieces, which I think is great.
That's very true. I hadn't really thought about that. Mm-hmm. And what I like about Ryan is he's not afraid to do something like that. And, these kinds of partnerships and an opportunity to meet a young, very talented composer and to hear this world premiere piece that will be on Saturday night's program mm-hmm. is tremendously exciting, and it certainly doesn't happen in every community. So we're absolutely thrilled for this partnership. And I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed our conversation today, mm-hmm. Patrick.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. And all the best to you, and we'll be following your career with great interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Gretchen.
We've been speaking with Patrick O'Malley, who is our Composer of the Year. His piece, Loneliness in a Beautiful Place, will be heard on the Saturday night program at the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. And with our time remaining, we're going to hear a portion of a work featured on Saturday night's program. It is The Sunken Cathedral of Claude Debussy. And we will hear that performed by members of the Philharmonia Orchestra led by Geoffrey Simon. Thank you for tuning in for Opus on Siouxland Public Media. I'm your host, Gretchen Gondek, wishing you a day filled with beautiful music. This is Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College.